Good morning. This is Lance Kenmore with the Kenmore team, and I'd like to welcome you to this week's edition of the Tri-Cities Real Estate Update. As always, you can contact me, Lance Kenmore, anytime direct on my cell phone at 727-8977 or visit us on the web at kenmoreteam.com. Once again, I always like to thank John for hosting and everybody here at the station for working to make this happen. John, how you doing?
The weather's warming up and baseball.
Oh, yeah. It's been nice. I think next week I'm hearing some of the 90 stuff.
That yes. By Tuesday, Wednesday, mid-90s.
Yeah. I've the last week of the upper 70s, 80s has been feeling pretty good for showings and hanging out for sure. Well, we have with us, as always, our in-house lending specialist, Mr. Mike Denslow with Home Street. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing good. I like that Home Street blue polo you got on. That's pretty nice. It says Kenmore Team on it, but it sure looks like Home Street blue.
You know, even though it's the radio, I like to get all matched up, you know, so I'm in the mode with you. Well, we always like to start off with our crazy national celebrity real estate story. And, man, it seems like there's been a lot of these, I call it turn-of-the-century iconic homes that are turning over right now. So this is part of the Carnegie Steel heir. Howard Phipps Jr. is now selling his family's Westbury 93-acre estate. So his father was Andrew Carnegie's partner in Carnegie Steel. And so, as you can imagine, one of the iconic wealth-building, you know, mechanisms in U.S. history. And so they had built an estate known as Erkless is the name of the estate. 26 rooms, 15 bedrooms in this property, and it has, the main house is 16,000 square feet. I mean, this was aristocratic, iconic money on another scale. And then it also has two greenhouses, a horse stable, three barns, and a caretaker's house. So, pretty interesting. And what got me about the story that made me laugh out loud was I didn't quite realize the age, but there was a line in there that said the 83-year-old is ready to downsize. So I think it was a bit much for him. Life changes, but interesting to see those estates, you know, went through two generations, but is not going to make it to the third generation.
So one of my favorite comedians, Brian Regan, says, you can call that a mansion unless you live there. You can't call your own house a mansion, but everyone else can.
Okay, perfect. A new real estate line I picked up today from Mike Denslow.
That well, awesome. how pompous is it saying, hey, let's go back to my mansion.
Right. Absolutely. Oh, my gosh. That is a great line, Mike. I love it. Love it. Well, we always like to counteract that and take a look at what's going on in our local market here at the Tri-Cities. Last weekend, we talked about inventory finally making some gains into the 600s, which still isn't what we would call, you know, an overabundance of homes available. But
I will go back to last time I was on the air that we talked about those people transitioning early summer, the people that have their act together are getting their houses listed right when their kids are wrapping up school to make sure all this happens during summer before they get back into fall.
Absolutely, Mike. And so that has given our buyers a lot more options. We've had buyers that have been on the sidelines for 2 or 3 months, had gotten beat out 4 or 5 times in multiple offer situations in the spring. And over the course of the last 2 weeks, I got to tell you, for anybody out there listening or a family member that knows that this has happened to somebody, if somebody was extremely frustrated in the last 3 to 4 months and gave up their house search, now's a great time to start that back up give us a call over at the Kenmore team, because my buyer's agents have kept their list and stayed in contact with their buyers. And just over the course of the last week and a half, we have popped a lot of those buyers into properties with the newer amount of inventory on the market. So good, really, really active market right now. One of the things I wanted to talk about, we go over this with clients and people when we're talking, and our agents. And I had a couple situations come up over the last 3 weeks, and that's how we always come up with the majority of our topics for the show, is Mike and I look at what are people saying, what is the on the street, what's happening, and what do we hear, and come up with a show topic.
And what tough lessons have been learned.
Yes, absolutely. And so today's topic is what I call navigating the counteroffer. And so a lot of times people have differing opinions on what's going to happen in this situation. But really, when a buyer makes an offer to a seller, the seller has basically four choices. Number one, they could just sign that offer as is and accept it. Number two, they could just flat out reject the offer, just say no. Number three, they could actually say nothing and just let the offer expire. Buyers normally will put a anywhere from a 12 to 24 hour to pretty standard practices like a 2 day, 48 hour turnaround time on the offer, that once it expires, if it's not signed, no longer valid. So a owner or a seller could just ignore an offer, let it expire. And then the fourth option, which is really kind of what we're highlighting today, is they could make some sort of counteroffer.
And Lance, this is what I want you to talk about. I want you to talk about the contractualness of that counter, and then who has the power and all of that. Because there's a lot of misconception on, okay, when they counter, then what?
Great. And Mike doesn't know that I prepared a 30-minute show and he just added another 10 minutes to me. that is a great, great point. And so what happens in that situation, and what Mike's talking about, and I'm so glad you missed it. I didn't even think about putting that on when I was prepping for the show.
Well, that's happened before, and that's happened between you and I and buyers. And then they're...
Absolutely.
And they're like, oh, well, I can counter back, and then we're going to come to a medium, but then another offer comes in. And
absolutely. So what can happen, and what Mike's describing, is seller receives an offer and from buyer, and maybe buyer went in kind of low and weren't quite willing to pay the price, or there was something that needed to be changed. So the seller gets the offer, and the seller changes, say, two or three items on the offer. They say, you know, we can't close in 45 days. We want you to close in 30. And you offered us 180 and we wanted 200. So we're going to go back at 200 and we're going to close in 30 days. That was the seller's counteroffer. Changed those two terms. Now, buyer says, okay, here's what I'll do. I'll pay him the 200, but I got to have the 45 days. There's no way I can close in 30. Buyer sends that offer back to seller. In the meantime, while the seller's thinking about it, seller receives another offer. Now, mind you, they've agreed on price. The buyer thinks this is a no-brainer. They're just asked for 15 more days. Seller receives another offer that is at the price and with a 30-day close. Seller ignores buyer's counteroffer because now seller is under no obligation to respond to buyer's second counteroffer. They do not have to. There's no time. If there's a time period given by the buyer, it can expire, and they're not obligated. So seller just goes completely dark, as I call it in the CIA, which I know nothing about, but my TV language is. Seller goes dark, ignores buyer's second counteroffer, and executes a contract with buyer number two.
Okay, now let's go back to what would have happened if that second offer from buyer number two would have happened when the seller countered back and the ball was in the court of buyer number one?
This is a great question, Mike, and this gets really sticky. So, yes. So, buyer made an offer to seller. Seller didn't like two of the terms. Seller countered to buyer. Buyer number two comes in and has a much better offer. Let's say $10,000 over what seller just countered to the first buyer. But what happens in this situation is seller has an active counteroffer out to a buyer. Now, two things can happen. Probably 20 things. But the two basics is that the buyer can, the buyer number one can accept the counteroffer from the seller. Or what can happen is before any time before receiving that acceptance from the buyer, the seller can withdraw their counteroffer.
Which is always going to mean that there's another offer on the table.
Which always means there's another offer. And it's a very rare, rare instance. And when it happens, people get mad. Yeah. Mad. My phone starts blowing up. Expletives start flowing from agents, other clients, parents of kids buying the first-time home buyer.
Buyers saying, how did this happen?
Yes. The buyer is like, how can they withdraw their counteroffer they just gave us? And so the risk always is to that buyer, because buyers will say, well, gosh, I was just going to take tonight to think about it. How can they withdraw their counteroffer? But they can, and most people are not aware of that situation because their agent didn't explain it to them. And so when it happens, it is really shocking. And like Mike said, it always means there's a better offer out there on the table. And so the only way that could have locked that in prior to getting that withdrawal is to have signed that offer and returned it, have delivery back to the
proof,
other client.
Proof of delivery, fax, email, what?
Yes, fax, email, or delivery with receipt in person. And so email is is rapidly become the standard that we use. A little known fact, though, is that the contract states the email addresses that must be used to prove delivery. So if you don't have those email addresses correct, and you have to have two email addresses, if they're not delivered to both, then you don't really have delivery.
If people are listening to this show, as I am sitting here listening to you explain it, and McKay as well, this is just yet another reason to use a good, reputable real estate agent. Because you can imagine navigating these waters by yourself.
Oh, absolutely. People bring me contracts all the time that were done, and they said, hey, I think we messed this up. You know, here's the contract we used, and it's a 2-page contract. Ours is 17.
And well, yours is the Washington State.
Ours is the Washington State, 17 pages with addendums. And you see a 2-pager, and you read through it. We're not allowed to give legal advice, but I shake my head, and inside my head, I'm saying to myself, you know, this is the scariest thing I've seen in a long time. We have to refer them to legal counsel to determine the legality of that 2-page contract. But you can imagine what can go on 2 pages versus what can go on 17.
And what we're trying to avoid here in the mortgage world as well is the gray area.
Absolutely.
This is a transaction.
That's exactly what happens, and it's very spelled out very specifically. Now, the next point I wanted to make about counteroffers is the number one thing is to get your leverage in the counteroffer negotiating is information. If you receive a counteroffer from the seller, you want to know, why did I receive that counteroffer? You want to talk to the other agent and the client. Why do they want 30 days instead of 45? Sometimes you'll make a phone call and they'll say, well, because our new construction house is done and we want to move before school starts. Or they might say, our job transfer is on the 5th. We want to close on the 2nd. And then make the move for the job transfer.
The last buyer fell through and we had everything ready to go. Yes. And we've got another house waiting and we're going to lose out on that house if we don't close by. They only gave us one more extension. by X.
Absolutely. So if you're a buyer and you find this information out, you can say to yourself, okay, now I see why they want the date is so important. I'm going to have to stay in my apartment another month because of the way they want it. And that I'll be paying for. So I tell you what, if let's hit that date for the seller, make them happy, and maybe I'll shave a little bit off the price. Yep. And if you know what's more important to the seller and the buyer together, a lot of times that offer will come together.
I like the word you used, navigate. You've got an expert on your team that is helping you navigate difficult waters.
Absolutely. And when we come back, I'm going to give you the number one tip and number one negotiating mistake that people make in counteroffers.
And that is a tease officially from Lance Canmore.
Right here on News Talk 870.
Welcome back to the Tri-Cities Real Estate Update. Today we've been talking about the intricacies of counteroffers. There's a lot of misconceptions out there. Mike talked about it before the break. When a contract is binding, when you officially make a change to a contract, it becomes a counteroffer. And when it goes to the other party, it's not binding until the other party initials and sends that back. I have had deals where we were waiting on one initial and it was something like, for instance, changing a title company, which is not a big deal, and another offer came in. And I am legally obligated when that happens, and this is the hardest thing for real estate agents to do because it can make you look like a complete schmuck in front of your other fellow realtors.
But, and the clients.
The other clients. But what's happened, but they don't understand, like the other agents' clients also, and this is what happens in the real estate world, is another offer comes in. I am 100% legally obligated to present that offer to the seller. That is my agency law duty, meaning if not, I can lose my license. So if we're waiting on an initial to change a title company, all other terms are set and good, and we get another offer that nets the seller $10,000 more. Now, I've had some sellers say, Lance, you know what? It's a done deal. This is one initial on a title company change. I told them that's what I'm doing. I'm going with this other buyer. I'm rejecting the second offer. I've also had clients that said, hey, I really like those other people, but I don't know them from anybody. And I really need this $10,000 for my family to move to the next town where we're going to. So I know we just changed the title company, but I want you to withdraw my counteroffer so that we can take this other offer because it's not a done deal. And those are hard. Like, the law requires me to present those options, follow my client's wishes, and that means that the other buyer and the other agent in town that I do business with the next 5 years hate me and blame me for that happening. The good agents don't blame me. They know. But sometimes even the agents don't understand. And so, you know, they get really upset and throw stones. But those are the things that can happen in counter offer intricacies that we have to look at. Now, a tip that can help you in real estate or not real estate, but number one tip in counter offer negotiations that we go by, that a lot of people ignore, is never negotiate on one item. So for instance, if you present an offer and it's a $200,000 sales price, the offer comes in at $190,000, and you immediately think, well, geez, I think I should just go back at $195,000 and split the difference. You might want to think that through, because what happens is if you're only negotiating on one item, you're presenting a win-lose scenario. Somebody's going to win because they're going to get a higher price than they wanted, or somebody's going to lose because they're going to get a lower price than they wanted. Now, Let's say, for instance, there's a second item that you don't even really care about. Hmm. Maybe the closing date was 45 days, and you want to close in 40. So what you do is you toss that counteroffer back. You put it at the price you want, but maybe you change the closing date by 5 or 7 days. For what reason, do you say? No reason at all, other than to think, make the buyer think that they're winning on something. Because now, if you're negotiating on two items, you can set up a win-win, meaning one of those items is going to be more important to the other party. They're both going to come out of that negotiation thinking that they won if you're negotiating on two items instead of one.
Hmm. McKay, do you... That's funny. I hadn't thought about that. I don't sell real estate. So,
McKay, let me give you this option. Let's take it out of the world of real estate.
Okay.
And let's take it to your son. And your son has a curfew at 10 o'clock.
Yes.
And he comes and he says, Dad, Friday night, there's a big party. I need curfew to be 10:30. As a parent, your natural response is... No.
Bleep, no.
Yeah, right. So then he goes, oh, come on, Dad, just this one time again. No. But now think about, now your son smartens up a little bit and says, gosh, you know what? Dad has been asking me to mow and fertilize the lawn for like 3 days. So now he comes at you and says, Dad, how about this? I'm going to mow and fertilize the lawn before tonight's over. And if I get that done, can I stay out 30 minutes later until 10:30? I can see, McKay, now you're thinking about it.
Yeah.
And the difference is there, he probably was going to have to mow and fertilize the lawn anyway because McKay was eventually going to beat it out of him.
but, yes, I was. Well, he knows.
But now you're negotiating on two items. And even if it's something simple like that, it makes you stop and think. You're like, oh, yeah, you know what? You are giving me something else, and so I will. So in negotiating classes and stuff that we've been through, this is always something that we're working on and fine-tuning and finding that extra item. So when you're in those negotiations, think about negotiating on two or three items instead of one item, and you have a much better chance of getting deals put together.
See, yet another reason why would you ever do a FSBO?
There you go, McKay. I love it. But what we need to do is we need to check in with Mike Denslow. It's a big topic today. I've talked a lot. I'm sure people are changing channels to listen to better songs. But McKay, we need to talk to Mike Denslow at Home Street and say, Mike, what's going on in the lending world over there? What are you dealing with?
Well, I was equating your topic of the counteroffer to do I lock or do I not?
Oh, that is a question that's a tough one.
Yeah.
Or maybe not. You tell me.
Well, it's risk-reward, really. What I like to do is I like to show people rates. Let's say today's rate was X. I like to show them an eighth under and an eighth more. And then say, okay, if rates go down, this is what your payment looks like. If rates go up, this is what your payment looks like. You know, we're looking at a 45-day close, so a 45-day lock. This is what everything looks like. What would you like to do? And I always get the standard question, well, what are rates going to do the next 30 days? let me get out the crystal ball and let you know. Our crystal ball only lasts a few hours because right. What we can look at is the mortgage-backed securities pricing of that particular day. Let's say in the afternoon, we can look at what the stock market's doing, and we can make a guess that in the morning, if nothing radical happens, that this is what's going to happen with rates. But nobody knows beyond that. I mean, people talk about, oh, well, the Fed did this or that. And that's the Fed rate. That's not mortgage rates. And most of the time, mortgage rates have anticipated whatever the Fed's going to do. And so unless they do something surprising, it's already built into the rates. So and don't worry about that there. But most people lock because they want to know. They're like, hey, I'm under contract. I want to move forward. I want to lock in. Occasionally, somebody will say, yeah, let's wait a week and see what happens. But all I can do is arm them with information to help them navigate,
absolutely.
Using your word.
I like it.
And you know, they know all the different things that can happen. They know what it looks like if rates go up. They know what it looks like if rates go down. And, you know, make a choice. And what I say is, if you can't sleep without your rate being locked, then okay, then you can you're going to lock in your rate. If you don't, if you're a gambler, then okay, then keep asking me. I'll keep telling you what rates are, and we'll lock when you're ready.
No, that's good advice, Mike. And I think, you know, too, I like how you said arming people with that information, because people can look at a year trending graph. And like you said, if you knew exactly where rates were going to go, you would be on Wall Street trading and you'd be making millions of bucks because you'd know exactly where the rates were all the time.
Oh, no. In that hypothetical world, I'm already retired.
Oh, okay. Perfect.
See,
good,
but
good.
Then what would happen is you'd be so good that the Securities and Exchange Commission would start asking you questions.
Valid point, McKay.
Absolutely. But it's nice because you give them that information and then people that can say, and the worst thing that can happen, and I've seen this happen before, is you qualify somebody on a current today's rate, and if their ratios are really close or tight on if they can get that mortgage, if they don't lock and rates go up, it could actually, at when they get ready to close on a home 4 months later, they might not qualify anymore because of the payment. So I know in those tight situations, you really have to watch that, to where it might be a safety issue of, geez, if we don't lock, there's the risk that you couldn't get the house.
Yeah, if the debt to income ratio is that tight, I mean, you got to play it safe.
Absolutely. So a lot of different scenarios to go through. And much like we talked about counteroffers and dealing with counteroffers, this is why I just send people to Mike. They start asking me those questions like that, and I just start saying, you know, I just keep handing out his cards to them. And because there's a lot of intricacies in that world that I don't know about. I mean, I know from when you and I talk and what we've seen in history, but a lot of stuff happens on your side of the table in your job, and I just turn the clients over to you at Home Street.
Well, the same goes back to real estate. I'm not going to answer real estate questions. And you know what? Running a control board?
Yeah.
We don't know how to do that either. So that's why McKay's here.
Absolutely. Good information. I do have my last point, though, about counteroffers. So we have a successful negotiation. We negotiated on two or three items. The deal's all signed around. We're moving forward. Mike, is there going to be another opportunity for a counteroffer moving forward?
Inspection contingency. Yeah.
Mike, I didn't even prep him on that. And that is what happens. And I tell people is we've negotiated the initial deal. But once the buyer has armed themselves with all the real information about the house and what lies beneath and underground and in closets, the buyer then has an opportunity to potentially counteroffer, you could call it that, or renegotiate the deal based upon the information. So there's going to be potentially a different counteroffer in that situation.
Then there's another one too.
There is one more, and the lender would bring this up, and I brought it up, and I know, Mike, what you're going to say. Mike, you're talking about the appraisal.
Yep.
And if the value of the home does not match with the appraisal, once again, mechanisms kick into place, which can bring about another counteroffer and renegotiation.
So a house is listed for $200,000. Somebody says they're willing to pay $205,000. They get the house, and guess what? It appraises for $200,000.
Absolutely. And so now the buyer has to decide, because the bank won't lend on any more than their, say it's 80% of $200,000, even though they wrote down $205,000, the bank won't lend 80% of $205,000. They'll only lend 80% of $200,000.
Contract price or appraised value, which is ever lower.
So the buyer has to decide, do I pay the extra $5,000? Do I ask the seller to reduce to the $200,000, which the bank says it's only worth? And will the seller accept that option? Or are we going to meet in the middle Or are we going to cancel the deal?
Well, you know what? If you decide to meet in the middle, you should probably change another thing to the contract, right, McKay? Not so it's not just one thing.
Absolutely. So, yeah, those items come up. Really, three potential major points for counteroffers. If you need any help with situations like this, go to KenMorteen.com. Shoot us a message. We live and breathe this stuff. I love this stuff.
Work with an expert.
And we will be working on offers, negotiating and counteroffering all weekend. But send us a message if you need some help. We would love to help. And we will be right back here next week.
Right here on News Talk 870.